I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. My next guest has just written a memoir about his travels through Africa. The book is entitled The Timbuktu for a Haircut, A Journey Through West Africa. It is a very readable account of an unforgettable journey Rick Atkinson had through Senegal and Mali by train, four-wheel drive, boat, camel, and foot. The book is fun and funny and a great insight into that part of the world. Rick Atkinson is the president and CEO of Tourism Vancouver and a director of the Pacific Asia Travel Association. To Timbuktu for Haircut is published by Dundurn and retails for $26.99. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Rick Atkinson. Good morning, Mr. Atkinson.
Good morning. Thank you for having me by.
Thanks for joining us. Timbuktu is such an iconic place, legendary, almost for centuries. Why?
In the 1400s and the 1300s, Timbuktu was to Africa more important as a center of trade and of learning than either London or Paris would have been to Europe. And in part, this is that the gold from the south would come and trade with salt from the north, and it created a center of trade that was known outside of Africa, but Europeans did not know whereabouts it was. So its remoteness and its potential richness fascinated people.
How did it fascinate you?
You know, when I was a little kid, 4 years old, 5 years old, whenever Dad left the house, you know, we would say, "Where are you going, Daddy?" And he would say, in a sort of a toss-away line, he'd say, "I'm going to Timbuktu to get my haircut." And so from the earliest days, I had the notion that one day I better go to Timbuktu and get my haircut. Can't be very far. Dad was back in a couple of hours. So since childhood, Timbuktu fascinated me. And, of course, that only grew as I became an adult and had my own adventures in traveling, but had never been to Timbuktu.
And when did this all happen? This is a few years ago now?
Yes, it was a few years ago. The specific motivation for this journey was that I was taking a month off, going away all on my own. And about 6 months before that, my wife and I were in Prague, part of the Canadian delegation for the bid for the Olympics for 2010. The IOC was meeting to announce their decision, which of course became that the Games would be in Vancouver. And my wife and I were out for a glass of wine around midnight, a couple of nights before, and I said, "Look, it's only 6 months away. I better get ready. I got to choose a place to go." And she said, "Why don't you just go to Timbuktu?" And it was so spontaneous, and it struck me. And I said right then to Janice, "I am going to Timbuktu just as soon as I find out where it is."
And why didn't she go with you? Why did you choose to do this alone?
I thought of taking a month, which I had time that was available to me and wasn't necessarily available to Janice, and I was motivated to be on somewhat of a sabbatical, to have the time alone to think and journey on and do something that normally I'd not be able to undertake. I travel a lot for my role with Tourism Vancouver, and I just wanted to be somewhere that was rugged and individual, and that became my quest for Timbuktu.
How much do you travel a year?
Oh, I do a good 100,000 kilometers a year, every year, and it's a fascinating travel. It's part of marketing Vancouver to attract conventions here or to work with tour operators in other countries. So I end up in Asia a couple of times and in Europe a couple of times a year, and of course spots around North America.
You didn't know where Timbuktu was specifically. Did you know what it was about in terms of what to expect when you got there?
Well, two answers to that question. First of all, I thought it was in Africa, though many people don't even believe it exists, or they think it's in Russia or part of China. I did not know it was in the country of Mali, and that was intriguing. The whole French West Africa, now Senegal and Mali, the two countries I traveled in and some of their neighbors, have mixed reviews in the international media, and what I learned was that Mali is one of the African countries that makes sense and people are treated responsibly by their government. But the other part of the answer is that the intrigue of Timbuktu became much more than a name, and as I delved into it, I learned of the explorers from France or Britain or some of the other European countries that in the late 1700s or 1800s tried to get to Timbuktu to answer one of the big geographical questions of the day, where is Timbuktu? The other thing that flowed from that is, in my research, I came across mention on the History Channel on their website that in Timbuktu today, there are over 700,000 old manuscripts from hundreds of years ago that are deteriorating, that are in need of being saved and preserved. And that became an important thing for me to experience. I wanted to see these manuscripts.
These manuscripts are what, records of the government, politics, or history of the place? Or?
Yes, that, and religious writings or religious decisions or scholarly papers, many of them on astronomy or other areas of science, some on legal decisions, but many of them that are almost domestic documents about weddings or local goings-on in the society. And it's a remarkable collection. And because of the humidity and the bugs and the heat and the fact that these are often still in the corner of someone's home, much like you might have something in your attic forgotten, they are deteriorating. And there goes history one page at a time.
And the people there, are they not compelled to protect these things?
You know, it's in recent years, the last decade, there have been a number of initiatives, which may, in fact, be too little and far too late in the time to do this adequately. But the University of Norway has a program underway. South Africa has invested in this. There's a group called the Timbuktu Educational Foundation out of the United States that has been mandated to help save these. And What occurred was that there was incredible neglect for centuries, and then the realization that this is a treasure, and it has been called the greatest archaeological find since the Dead Sea Scrolls, and that gives, I think, a clear indication of the magnitude of learning we can get from these. So part of the royalties of Timbuktu for a haircut are dedicated to these other groups that are helping preserve the manuscripts.
TimbuktuFoundation.org is the website, is that correct?
That's correct.
How do you prepare for a journey like this? You said you had a month. Now, did you pack light? I know that you have a bit of a pack sack, did you, that you brought from here?
Yes, I probably overpacked. Would be reading and be very aware that I was going to be very dry in the mouth in the desert, and I sort of pack extra liquids, and I would be wondering about mystery meat for meals, and so I'd pack more granola bars, and I loaded up with that and realized going for a month, one needs to be medically prepared, and so traveling, the travel medical clinic is a great advisor on not just the shots you need, but packing needles in case you have to ask a medical practitioner to use the needle. You want to have your own and have them properly done and sanitized. So I did go with a fair amount of gear. I would go traveling lighter next time, but it served my purposes, and perhaps more importantly, it gave me the confidence that I sought going into what is literally still the middle of nowhere.
Did anything go wrong in the course of your journey?
You know, I so many things went right, and the people I was able to meet from Senegal or from Mali were exceptional, and I felt as though I'd encountered some of the best hosts anywhere in the world. I did have a sort of an escapade that unfolds throughout the story, and that was with a fellow who was helping with some ground operations for me, and I felt not done fairly by him in terms of some of the shenanigans that happened. And it entertained me but frustrated me, and I recount the incidents because it just kept on popping up as Mohammed's line in the narrative sort of descends toward the end. But happily, my guide, Zach, early 20s, who really became my teacher throughout much of the month that I was there, his line ascends and he becomes my hero.
Now, Muhammad is a travel agent, correct?
Correct.
How did you come across him? Like, I guess through the internet, I suppose, right?
No. Actually, when I was making the preparations, I had come across a guidebook that had a lot about Mali, and then in it there was reference of someone who once or twice a year would take a group of six or eight into Burkina Faso and then up into Mali and over into Senegal. And I contacted them. They were based in Europe. And after going back and forth a bit, they said, look, why don't you try this guy? He can help you with some of your arrangements, because I knew, I'd been told by the one other person I knew who had been to Timbuktu, it's of paramount importance to arrange for a guide and a driver for that part of your connection, 4x4, into Timbuktu for safety. And so I ended up making those arrangements through Muhammad, and that began the misadventures.
Did you set out to write a memoir or a guidebook or...
No, I didn't initially plan to write. What I did realize in all the preparatory work was that I had become fascinated with the history of the area and particularly a handful of explorers. Mungo Park, the great Scottish adventurer who twice, once 1795 and once early 1800s, tried to get to Timbuktu and was killed by the Tuaregs on his second attempt. And Gordon Lang, who left Britain and crossed the Sahara and ended up in Timbuktu, but 3 days later, as he was making his way home, was strangled and killed by his protectors. And these stories, as they unfolded, I realized I was sketching them out. And when I traveled, I found I was writing vignettes. I don't keep a journal, but I would write of incidents. And it was when I got back, I realized that I had begun to write something more than an article and something that had the potential to become a book.
Would you recommend going to Timbuktu? Like, I guess you'd have to be somewhat adventurous to want to embark on that sort of journey, correct?
Well, I would recommend it to someone that seeks the personal accomplishment of having been to a place name on a map that resonates. Part of it's that Timbuktu means, it still means, find me if you can, and it's like a place that's tried to hide from people. And I think every traveler wants to have been to a place that's special. So I would encourage that people travel in Mali, and if they can, do the considerable extra effort to make their way overland or on the River Niger and get to Timbuktu. But within Mali is also the Dagon area, and I trekked there for 10 days. And that, I would have to say, is what I hold the most special as the part of the trip. So I would say the goal for the traveler should be Mali, and if it delivers up a chance to see Timbuktu, then they should.
Is it a costly proposition, Rick?
It's not unreasonable. I ended up, I think because of the delights of Muhammad, paying a bit more for places that probably should have been a few dollars a night, and I'd paid more than that. As I mentioned in the book, I'd end up paying $75 for something that on many occasions was, it just wasn't there. But it's not that the magnitude of the additional cost was itself really, really notable or significant. That my irritation was more the feeling that I'd been taken advantage of. But in terms of getting on the train I was on for 2.5 days between Dakar on the west coast of Senegal into Bamako, the capital of Mali, that was a reasonable cost. And food or the freshness of bread. I mean, this is, when the French left, they did leave behind some culinary expertise, and the breads are some of the most wonderful breads in the world. And so in that way, it was, things were affordable. But if you if you're arranging for a 4x4 transportation or to be on a panass, a boat on the river, those things can, you know, you need to be having the cash with you to do those.
You work in tourism. Do you think North Americans, do we pay much attention to Africa? Do we travel to Africa very much? Do you see more of that?
Africa, in the newspapers, almost every time you read about it, is about peril and about misfortune, and it doesn't sound like a place that is inviting the world yet. You know, South Africa, of course, or Tanzania, places like that have had quite prominent tourism inflows, and so in that way, it's open and it's certainly rewarding to the travelers that go. The potential for the future, I think, is really quite special, because it's still an undiscovered continent for most people. It's something that people have experienced through books or magazine articles or watching National Geographic on television, and it is everything astounding that you could hope for in a travel experience. You just have to be prepared to put up with some inconveniences, and you have to be careful.
What sort of haircut did you eventually get?
Well, I did at the end of a day into the early evening get to a coiffeur, a barber, just on the roadside, and a small shack. And by the time he held a mirror up for me to take a gander in, I realized I'd had a Timbuktu trim. I was pretty much bald, and I would get haircuts wherever I can, because it's always a local excitement and just it's a bit of a lesson, and I like that. And so I hadn't specified anything. I just give me your haircut, and he did, and it was quite something. In fact, I don't remember my dad ever coming back from his thing going to Timbuktu for a haircut with anything near this until he was in his 50s and went bald.
Well, what did he think of you going there?
My dad?
Yeah.
You know, he's read the book. He was one of the first to read it, and he phoned me one night, and he said, you know, I'm on page 110. He said, I am so into the book. He said, I love it. I just keep forgetting that it's you. And then he said afterwards, he sent me a really nice note, and he said, it's not something that he would have seen himself doing, but he's fascinated that I did it. And I did send them a note from Timbuktu when I was there, and it said simply, you know, Mom and Dad, I'm in Timbuktu, I'm safe and healthy, and Dad, I'm going out to get a haircut.
While I've got you on here, the Tourism Vancouver's obviously plays a huge role in the road to 2010. How are we doing as Vancouverites, as a city? Are we prepared for 2010?
You know, Vancouver and Whistler, be the most prepared of host destinations for the Olympics. We're far ahead of where even Calgary, which did a very good job of hosting the Olympics, was when they were sort of a year and a half out. The facilities were there. The knowledge about what it's going to take is there. VanOck is an incredible organizing group. They've got some exceptional leadership. And what I think we're going to see, what I know we will see from Vancouver is a world spirit, and we will be ready to welcome people from all the different nations. And if done right, I hold with the view that sport and tourism sit on the right hand of peace, and this is an opportunity for people to gather in British Columbia and share a lot of things and celebrate our differences.
It is a story that you mentioned in the book, and it's not very long, so I'd like to ask why you don't wear a watch.
You know, there's a real simple answer, and that's that a number of years ago, my family and I were traveling, and we had our entire trip bumped back a week, and we were quite frustrated with the delays and the time frustrations, and this was traveling from in Russia, and when we arrived in Moscow to catch the flight to then Leningrad, which had been delayed a week, we were told, you know, you're really fortunate you weren't here a week ago because the plane crashed and a number of people on board had been killed. And I thought, how shameful that we get so preoccupied with time and the world serving us. And I thought, you know, time moves along just fine without me watching it. I took my watch off then, and I've not worn it since, and that was early 1970s.
Really? I came across that while reading the book, and I just thought, well, there must be more to this.
Yeah.
You must have enjoyed writing this, did you?
I loved it. Writing's important to me. I spent a lot of years in book publishing as part of my career, and had a great experience last year co-authoring a book on a lost gold mine up on Pitt Lake called Slumax Gold, and it did very well, had a lot of nice attention. And as this book came together, what I found as a writer was a chance to really think through, sometimes in a self-deprecating way, a little bit about what I wanted to put down on paper that I was comfortable with more than just family and friends reading and knowing. But it became important for me to help tell the story of Timbuktu, and it became very important to me to have a role in helping preserve the old manuscripts. To be able to do that by telling a story that had the adventure and had the chronology of a journey that few people get to take just rounded out the whole experience in a really, really fine way.
So you intend to write more, do you?
Yeah, this probably isn't uncommon, but, you know, I'm one of those people with a couple of other manuscripts in the top drawer that just don't get the attention they need, and time isn't always my best friend. So I would like to write more and in different areas, but it's really rewarding. And the thing that struck me on this is that you do find time to do the things that are important to you, whether it's to take a journey or to get up early in the morning or stay up late at night to write about it.
Rick, congratulations on this book and continued good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
The book is called To Timbuktu for a Haircut, A Journey Through West Africa, 26